This podcast is presented by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Enjoy the presentation.
It's my pleasure to welcome Mark Kanishi from the California Institute of Technology, Caltech. Welcome, Mark.
Thank you.
Mark is a world-renowned pioneer in the study of neuroethology, the study of how nervous systems generate natural behaviors. He has analyzed the neural circuits that underlie birdsong and determined the mechanisms by which auditory information is encoded in the nervous systems of both songbirds and barn owls. His research has provided a remarkable understanding of auditory physiology in the brain. The ultimate function of the nervous system, of course, is to generate behavior, and Mark's studies are the classic examples of starting with a behavior and working into the neural mechanisms that generate it. Mark, for you, understanding songbirds was a very early passion. How did you become interested in this?
I had lots of animals at home. My parents did not prohibit any bringing in any animals except cats that my mother disliked.
And did that lead on to an interest in songbirds? I remember bird watching as one of your early avocations.
When I kind of graduated from these ordinary domestic animals, I thought, well, something from the wild. And I was sort of a natural bird watcher. I did not belong to any group, but I became interested in watching birds. So that gave me the taste of dealing with birds.
I suspect that your deep familiarity with birds then may have been contributory when you left Japan, came to Berkeley for your graduate work, in your selection of bird song as a thesis topic. Tell us a bit about that.
When I graduated, I thought I wanted to go abroad because I was reading a book and articles about birds, and most of those articles and books came from abroad, and England and the United States. And so I applied for admission at the Berkeley, Yale, and Michigan.
I think you were accepted everywhere, as I recall.
Yeah, I got accepted, and I chose Berkeley because it had a very good vertebrate zoology group.
And then how did you tackle the problem? This is an interesting scientific problem, understanding the origins of songbirds that learn quite complex and beautiful songs. How did you approach this problem?
The first project was to see how birds recognize their own species by song. And at that time, tape recorders were rare, and particularly portable tape recorders are very rare. So I thought, okay, I want to know what component of song conveyed species information. And so I chose a bird which sang a quite simple song, like trill. Mm-hmm. Like this, 1, 2, 3, trill. So I tried to modify that song. And
you had a very ingenious way of doing this.
There was no computer, no imaging machine, nothing. Somebody told me tape, recording tape, is magnetic. And so I thought that maybe if I put ion file, and it will stick to the magnetized part of the tape, and that's where the sounds are. And indeed, it was like that. So I cut the tape and changed the distance between different sound. And made the intervals random. And however, when I played that song right in the field, a territorial bird came to the speaker. So I was pretty disappointed that it didn't work. And so I decided to change the subject.
One of the fascinating things about birds that sing is that they learn their songs and in a way that depends upon the song that they hear as they are young.
Right.
And you investigated that in a very incisive and, again, a very ingenious way. Could you tell us a bit about those experiments?
There was this idea with fixed action pattern, Many animals show fixed movement, stereotype movement, like animals walking on four legs, swimming, fish swimming.
Innate behavior.
Innate behavior.
Yes. It's
a definition of innate behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And they also assumed that these movement patterns are controlled by the central nervous system without any sensory control, no feedback. And there was lots of debate about it. So the debate was central versus peripheral. So I thought bird song would be a nice system to use to address this question. If birds need to hear their own voice to shape their song, that the peripheral control is involved. Sensory control is involved in vocal motor output. So I decided to carry on this experiment. All songbirds have two phases of song learning. First, there is an impressionable period, or sometimes called critical period, during which young birds memorize chuta song, either played or sung by their father, or played by from tape recorder by humans. And then several months later, when they develop sexually, they begin to sing. They, after so many months, they still remember the song they heard in the impressionable period. And so I deafened during the impressionable period, just after they learned a song from their fathers in the wild. So I deafened before the onset. And in the white-crowned sparrows, the deaf bird developed dramatically abnormal songs, like noise.
White noise.
It was astonishing.
Yes.
And Peter Mahler was finding that white-crowned sparrows raised in complete isolation in soundproof rooms developed simpler songs, but not this completely noisy song. So I developed a theory called the template theory. That is, young bird memorizes a tutor song, uses that song as a model to shape his own song. So the memorized song works as a template. And a young white crow is isolated in a chamber. He has no access to a tutor song. And he then, later, he will sing a simpler song. So that simpler song is due to an innate template that
Something is presumably genetically encoded,
in the
animal.
In the normal process, hearing a tutor song modifies that innate template to an acquired template. that's how it works.
Yes.
That's the theory.
Your early paper on this, Mark, was tremendously influential and, of course, really launched you into your spectacular career. It was a very important insight at a very early time when there was a great deal of debate about these issues. And it raises the very interesting question, what is different about the brains of songbirds? Do they have structures that non-singing birds lack? How do they have the ability to acquire these songs?
Well, later, my friend Fernando Notebaum, he found the song control system, which consists of several distinct areas. Good thing about this system is that this whole system is clearly visible and not diffuse. So we can say, okay, we go there and record neurons and so on.
So you can find groups of neurons in different regions of the brain that seem to have different functions, some of them listening to the tutor song, some of them listening to the bird's own song. Does it work like that?
At the moment, we know the vocal motor pathway from the forebrain through the midbrain to the hindbrain and the vocal organ. That's clear cut. But other areas, about five more areas, we don't know what functions these areas perform. Mm-hmm. Some people say it memory and so on, feedback and so on.
Yes.
But
yes.
We don't know.
Can we say at this point anything about the localization of the innate template and the acquired template? Or can we point to a particular region of the brain and identify that as the location of either of those?
Well, interestingly, my laboratory found that this motor pathway I mentioned, neurons in these areas perform both motor and auditory functions. This is incredible because bird cannot be singing and hearing at the same time using the same cells.
One would think not,
yeah,
yes.
These cells are firing, and if auditory input comes back, it will, mix up.
Fascinating.
And so this we still don't understand. But lately, some groups found an area outside the song system, although we think it's not outside, where neurons respond to the tutor song.
Uh-huh.
And the neurons I mentioned in the motor pathway respond to the bird's own song. And the bird's own song is always slightly different from the tutor song. And neurons can discriminate between the bird's own song and the tutor song.
And perhaps make a comparison that allows them to refine their own song?
No, it's the other way around. All birds originally reproduce the tutor song, and then they want to develop individual characteristics.
Creative artistry.
Yes.
Yes.
And birds use song for individual recognition. Mm-hmm. They have territories, and they know neighbors by their song. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Birds also use songs, I think, in courtship displays. Yeah. And here, of course, one wants to know whether the numbers of songs that a male bird can sing, or perhaps the length of the song, is in any way correlated with the bird's success in the courtship process.
Yes. Recent studies show that birds, within the same species, males that sing more different song types attract more females. The bird that sings the most complex song, it's called lyrebird in Australia. This bird is a songbird, but this big, this tall, and beautiful lyre.
Display, yes.
And this bird is just amazing. I heard one, I didn't see, but I heard and recordings are also available. They can imitate bulldozer noises, human voice, and wood choppers.
Chopping wood.
Chopping wood.
Gracious.
Yeah,
yes.
In one area.
Yes, yes.
Wood choppers started reduced their productivity. Mm. And so their boss investigated. And it was sort of strange, all my wood choppers are working. Mm-hmm. Well, a lyre bird was
who's out there making
imitating.
The sounds.
Yeah.
Wonderful, wonderful.
Yeah.
Mark, these studies of bird song have been all picked up by many people, and there's a lot of interest in trying to understand whether or not the lessons learned there have some relevance to the learning of human language. And indeed,
yes.
One of your former postdoctoral fellows, Allison Dope, now at UCSF, working with Pat Kuhl at the University of Washington, they've been looking at this. Do you think this is going to help us?
Yes, there are remarkable similarities between speech development and the song development. Humans have this critical period. I mean, not very sharply defined and not so short, but relative to the lifespan of man. There is clearly a critical period
yes.
of acquiring new speech and new languages. Mm-hmm. And so I think the age is like 15 or so. Beyond that, people have difficulties learning new languages.
Mm-hmm.
There are always exceptions, of
mm-hmm.
course.
Mm-hmm. So perhaps the mechanisms that are involved in songbirds may be seen again in young humans.
Yes.
Let me turn to the other major sphere of your research interests, the study of the auditory system of the barn owl. How did you get interested in this problem? This is quite a different set of issues.
Yes. I was interested in sound localization. And so when I heard Roger Payne, who is very active in the whale conservation now, reported in 1963 in this International Congress in the Netherlands how barn owls could catch prey mice in total darkness.
Very impressive feat.
It's a beautiful, he showed a beautiful infrared photographs and I thought one day I would like to study the brain mechanisms of this behavior.
And you have. I mean, you've gone on in your lab to do this. How do you do this in the laboratory? It's one thing to think of the owl out in the wild identifying a field mouse and coming in toward this. How, just mechanistically, how can you do this in a laboratory environment?
Well, I started this work in Princeton where I was teaching, and a bird watcher gave me three baby owls, and I raised them, and fortunately they bred. Mm. And so at one time I had as many as 21 owls. But I concentrated on behavioral studies initially, just replicate Payne's results, and then do a few more new things. I trained owls to stand still on the perch and would fly upon hearing either a real mouse rustling or recordings of mm-hmm. rustling.
Aha, so it's the rustling sound, which of course is very variable, that is the cue for the owl.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And this was a wonderful period that's continued right up to the present, Mark. My favorite one of your many discoveries was the way in which you then went on to identify a topographic map of auditory space. And you know, one is generally familiar with somatosensory maps. Sensory maps, the different regions on the body surface projecting to different regions in parts of the brain. But the idea of an auditory space map was, people predicted it was not, it didn't exist. So how did you tackle that?
Well, this is where ignorance or naivety helped. I dreamed of finding a map of auditory space. And it is partly because my former colleague, Jack Pettigrew, and I worked on the OWL's visual system immediately after I arrived at Caltech. And I was very much impressed by the direction sensitivity of visual cortical neurons. And when Jack and I finished collaboration, Jack asked me, what would you like to find in the auditory system? So I said, I like to find auditory neurons just like these visual neurons. But the idea of a map came from myself. That is, owls determine the location of a mouse so quickly, within the first 200 milliseconds.
Fifth of a second, yes, very
brief. So he's not spending a lot of time doing computation.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I thought there might be a lookup table.
Hmm.
Said, okay, this, oh, there, like this. Mm-hmm. And so lookup table in the form of a map.
In the brain. Yes.
From the first experiment, we had some encouraging news. We had the neurons with very sharp directionality. And then several weeks later, we could see a pattern of change as we recorded from different locations in this area.
Mm-hmm.
The neurons' direction sensitivity systematically changed.
Yes. So putting the loudspeaker at different points in space, then one had to move the electrode in the brain to corresponding nearby regions to capture the sounds. This was a profound discovery, and the remarkable thing, of course, is that that again opened many interesting doors, and you went on to map all of the circuitry from the brain. Interestingly, back down to the cochlea, so that now there's a very complete understanding of this circuit. As we close here, I do have one final question for you, one that I hope will be intriguing for you. If there were an all-knowing, omniscient deity whom we could ask a question of, what question would you ask?
Well, quite simple. That is, I want to know how to visualize the entire neural circuit. Because now I think, after working on the owl's brain and songbird brain, wiring diagram, neuronal wiring diagrams are so important for physiology. So both physiology and anatomy must be pushed together.
Mm-hmm.
And fortunately, I think the field is going in that direction. And then we can really correlate brain circuit design and behavior. And we can go as far as, you know, memory problems will be understood, the mechanisms of memories will be understood, and even consciousness, we can go as far. You see, I'm always a bit skeptical about the discussion of about consciousness, but I always said we have to do both physiological and anatomical studies to understand the consciousness. And both Francis Crick and Christoph Koch agreed with me. They said yes.
More work is needed.
Yes.
Very nice, Mark. Very nice. Thank you so much for joining me on UCSD Guestbook. And thank you for joining us here.
You've been listening to a podcast from University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Thank you for listening.